You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots, open source, community, solar-powered radio. Broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And we have a real cultural show for us today, don't
we? Yes, we do.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host, Mommy, Caroline Kilborn.
It was a little bit of a frog today.
So, what have you been reading, Mom?
Oh, gosh, what have I been reading? Well, you know, you had gotten three books in the mail, and so I've been reading some of those.
Yeah, we've been, we actually have quite a number of guest prospects that have sent us books that we're trying to go through and see which ones we think would make good shows. We have some really interesting ones. Next week we have Sophie Burnham, I believe is her name, with The Book of Angels, which was published 20 years ago or so, and it just came out again.
Oh, and revised a little bit, because I have the original, and then...
And I now have the revised version.
But it's very, very
right.
Good.
And we have one coming up at the end of May about A Train to Nowhere.
Immigration.
About it was in Iowa. I think Denison, Iowa is where it was set, where they found bodies in a freight car some years ago and tracked back to what actually happened to all those. So, we've got lots of interesting upcoming shows. Yeah. From a kind of a different perspective, really.
That was a very interesting one.
Well, our guests today we're starting out with a two-part show, all with one theme, and the theme is the book as art form. And our first two guests are both longtime Fairfield residents who are both artists. And
yes,
absolutely. We have Betsy Dockhorn and Tony Dior, both artists, both longtime Fairfield residents, and both have studied at the University of Iowa Center for the Book for a number of years. And
Center for the Book.
So, welcome to Writers' Voices, Betsy and Tony.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we have to give credit to Paul Gandy. For this show was his idea. He saw Betsy and Tony's work at the Flying Leap Art Studio at the last Art Walk and said, "You should do a show with these guys."
Very good. Yep. Thank you, Paul.
So, Betsy, let's start with you because your letter project is sort of what inspired this show.
Right.
So tell us what this is and where the idea came from and what you're doing.
I have had a space that I created within the Flying Leap art space in December, starting with the December Art Walk. My idea was to collect letters, memories, stories, recollections from people as they pass through. I set up my typewriter, and I invited people to sit down with me and dictate a letter to me, some sort of memory, to a friend, to a family member, someone that they hadn't been in contact with for a while. Maybe they just had a question, some feeling that they wanted to express. So that was how kind of it started here in Fairfield last December. I have been there at the Flying Leap Art Space, you know, since that time, and I've collected probably about 110 or 20 letters from people that have simply sat down and shared something with me.
And what's the title of your project? Does it have a title?
The title is, yes, Dictation, Tell Me a Letter. And it's, they tell me what they want to say, and I type it out, no editing, no comment, with a manual typewriter, my little Smith Corona. People often respond that when they hear it at the front of this art space before they come into this room where I'm set up, they hear the sound and it's very nostalgic. It reminds them of college days or their father pounding away or their mother. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sort of reminiscent kind of tone or sound which sort of sets up the space for people to come and at least be curious about what's going on. And then they respond. They want to sit down and tell me something.
Can you still get ribbon?
Yes. Yes. In fact, Jerry, I think his name is Jerry at Walker's, kind of went over my typewriter for me, got me ribbons. Very helpful. Yeah, it's a little...
Yeah, because I have an Olympia at home, and my ribbon is kaput.
Yeah.
And I would love to get a ribbon.
Yeah, I've been able to get them locally, and there are sources online, and there's actually a really masterful typewriter repair person in Iowa City.
That's amazing, yeah, really.
They will work on these old typewriters.
So there are still people out there using typewriters on an ongoing basis, do you think?
I don't think so. Tony could speak to this, too. I mean, we use them. It's more as an artifact kind of involving text in artists' books and that kind of thing, other mixed media kind of artwork. There are not very many people that go around with a typewriter and set up shop and, you know, take down letters for people or stories. I can mention that the way that I kind of got jump-started on this project was last summer at the University of Iowa. I participated in was a graduate seminar in healing and writing for the healing arts. Mm. And as a result of that seminar, I started researching artists who were doing work kind of in the related field of the healing arts. And I came upon a woman, Cheryl Ohring, who I believe is in New York, who was doing kind of a project with her typewriter, moving around. And this specific project was writing to ancestors. And she would go to specifically synagogues. And this was one part of the work that she did. And she would take down letters from people who had something to say to their relatives. And then that was kind of the end of it. She gave them a copy, as I did. So that was kind of what intrigued me, and that was where my idea started. Oh, type letters and give them copies. My subject matter is different. There are other artists who have done similar kinds of work, Li Mingwei, Anne Hamilton, other important kind of conceptual work around text and writing as a medium of exploration in art and history and healing and story. And
now you're using a typewriter, you're using carbon paper, correct?
Yes.
And that's still
and
available?
Onion skin. Well, carbon paper is, and I actually wanted to use onion skin. But I couldn't find authentic onion skin, so it's actually tracing paper, which
you
is
know,
the closest
I might
that I can
have
get.
A stack.
Well, I would love it. I had a ream of it, and after years of hauling it around in all my moves, I threw it away, and then I was really lamenting.
I think I have a ream of it.
That would be great. And any of the listeners, if you have any onion skin, you know, get it to Monica, and I'll put it to good use, because I'm going to make an installation. My idea is that when I get enough letters accumulated, and I have a few here, I'd like to read them, some really poignant ones. I'm going to decompose them in a particular way and then integrate them together into an art piece so that they won't be...
Now, what does decompose them
It's a little
mean?
Mysterious, and I'm not being more specific because I don't want to give it away, but everybody who's come and sat with me has understood that the work is, and everything that they have to say is very private. The few letters that I brought today, I checked with the people that I knew who had written them to see if it would be okay if I read their letters, and they said yes. Sometimes people didn't want to say anything about family or friend. It was a little kind of an unapproachable arena of kind of emotionality. But getting back to the art, the installation, I'll put them back together in a way that will, so that all of the letters will be part of the whole, but they won't be recognizable as,
interesting.
As themselves, interesting. As the form of the letter.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to you so you can read some of these, but let's talk to Tony for a minute.
Okay.
Because your tiny books at the Flying Leap Art Studio were also part of what inspired this show. So tell us a little bit about your history as an artist and how you came to make this particular
art form.
Let's see. I have been interested in the physicality of the book, I think, ever since I was in grade school. And I can remember getting the textbooks, and I love the smell, I love the feel, uh-huh. I love to carry them around.
Yeah.
And that interest in the sort of physical nature of the book, I think that propelled me to focus on that and artistically create sculptural books. So my work at the Flying Leap it's all centered around the book as an object that can be read, but they're more sculptural than they are a container of information. That's usually what we think of as books. So I started studying probably about 12 years ago at the University of Iowa Center for the Book. And primarily I've taken classes in book binding. So I learned the traditional way to hand bind a book. And it's all about, for me, the interest is in the kind of linen thread that you use, the handmade papers that you use.
Do you make your own papers?
The glue that you use.
I don't make my own paper. But I'm fascinated with handmade papers. I've done some printmaking, letterpress printing in particular, which is a historical way of printing books. And now there's a sort of resurgence of letterpress printing, in the world of handmade artist books.
Well, you're right. We're used to thinking of the book primarily as a purveyor of information. The mm-hmm. content is what we look at more than the physical form of the book itself. But if you go back to the origins of the book, I'm thinking of the Book of Kells that I saw at Trinity University mm-hmm. in Dublin.
That the manuscripts that were
wow,
made.
Yeah,
oh,
that was
the historical manuscripts they're so lovely in themselves.
Yeah. Well, and the illustration is as important as the text, which were of course all hand done prior to Gutenberg,
right?
Around 1435 or 50,
right?
So they were all handmade then. And are there actually people at the University of Iowa who are phenomenally skilled in the art of calligraphy, illumination, medieval scholars? And I'll just say also that just in the past year, the university has developed an MFA program in the book arts, which really places the University of Iowa
wow.
nationally. I think there are only other four institutions that have a credential offered like this. So it's
wow.
really quite significant. And also, as regards papermaking, let me just say a little plug for Tim Barrett, who was received a MacArthur Award in 2009 for his work, brilliant work as a papermaker, hand papermaker.
And where is he?
He's at the Center for the Book, and he actually started.
He's the founder of the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wonderful person. And
yeah,
so over the years, what we have learned there, I think Tony and I took classes together and also independently of each other, you know, has really been phenomenal. And I'm finishing up there now.
Now, when you say finishing up there, what does that mean?
Well, yeah. I got back to college about a year and a half ago to finish my undergraduate after all these years, you know.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Only 2 weeks left. Really strenuous right now, you know, final projects and studio work. But it's been very satisfying. I'll be sad to leave, you know, the hallowed halls,
yeah.
The hallowed halls of North
academia.
Yeah.
So then will you continue with the master's, do you think, after that? Or
I don't think so.
Okay.
I will hopefully continue to take a class from time to time. There are many that, in spite of the fact that we have both been involved for many years, I think probably 10 years for me, They're classes that I haven't taken by particular instructors.
Now, is the Center for the Book part of the University of Iowa?
Yes.
It's a graduate program that has been, they've offered a certificate up until most recently, and now they'll offer both a certificate for graduate work and also the master's.
And but you could take classes there without being enrolled in the university itself?
No, you have to enroll in the university, but you don't have to necessarily
be in a degree program.
Be in a degree program to take the classes.
That's good.
So how about you? Are you going to work towards the master's?
No, I'm not. I've been taking classes all along, but I knew I wasn't going toward the certificate program or master's. But I knew that from the very beginning, from when I first moved to Iowa in 1985, that this program existed and that it was very well respected around the country. And so I thought, well, this is perfect. It's not too far from Fairfield, and I can take advantage of the expertise.
So your interest in the book as art is very longstanding.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. And, I mean, I've been doing it along with making a living as a caterer here in Fairfield, but I... Whenever I get a chance, I kind of squirrel away and work on my tiny books on my tiny table
in our tiny house. Oh, it's not so tiny anymore.
They added on. I would like to acknowledge we just had a visitor from the Fairfield Women's Club who brought some home-baked cookies as a thank you for the crew staff and for all the crew and the announcements that we do, the public service announcements.
Yeah.
Ah,
that's
okay.
Nice.
Yeah. So thank you to the Fairfield Women's Club. We really appreciate that. So, yes, we wanted to make sure we have time to hear these letters. So
let me just say about Toni, I want her to mention for sure that part of the work, she got an Iowa Arts Council Award grant for...
And that's what led to the show at the Flying Leap Art Space, which is going to be up for another month. But, yes, last year I applied to the Iowa Arts Council, and my proposal was to create two artist books, and each in an edition of 15. So they're small edition books that I've done by hand. And then most recently, just yesterday actually, I went to the University of Iowa Special Collections and met with David Schoonover, the curator of Special Collections, and he bought a couple of my books for their collection.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
Kudos to
absolutely. Yeah, so the books that are on display at Flying Leap, each one is one of 15?
Not all of them. Some of them are one of the kind. They're all marked. But there are, I think, four that are one of... a small edition, 10 or 15.
And how much, like, this is might be kind of a silly question, but in terms of the overall presentation, how much of it is the physical form? And but you do have words in them too.
Yes,
how much
I do.
Attention do you put on the words?
It depends upon the book. Let's see, there was one book that I letterpress printed. It's a book called The Sum of the Parts. I refer to it as a bird book, but...
a bird book.
and I was influenced. I made that book in the spring, and we have a bird feeder outside of our window, and I realized that I was very influenced by those birds, and that... So I wrote some fragments of phrases that I spent a fair amount of time with, and then created relief plates and printed those to go along with the book. And it's hard for me to say how much time, but it's the physicality of the book that really motivates me.
Wow. Right.
Now, with your project, it's maybe more towards the content than the physicality or both?
At this stage, letters project, yes. It's definitely about collecting content, although, as I said, I don't do any editing. You know, I don't correct punctuation or grammar or their pauses or anything. I'm simply taking down this information. When I get to the installation part or the next stage, which will be compiling all of these letters, I want to get about 150, I think, is what the right number. then that will be definitely hands-on, and I'll then begin to affect, I'll work with the materiality of the pages of this very thin paper.
And did you, as people were dictating to you, were there any real surprises?
Yes, there were some big surprises. It was really wonderful. I love the way people would just, the people that wanted to sit down were completely open-hearted and just, a lot of them didn't know me. People just wander into the gallery, hear the typewriter or whatever, and come back and sit down. Really open, a lot of them very deep. One man wrote a letter to his wife about having been divorced some years ago and that he was sorry that he didn't understand at that time what she was going through. And then there's a letter that, one of the most poignant ones I have, which I actually took up to my advisor, Dr. Rachel Williams, which brought her to tears, was, I won't mention any names.
Okay.
This is a letter to a daughter from a mother, and it says, "Dear daughter, all is well. I am searching for you. Please call home. Love, Mom."
Oh.
And so tender and moving. Then here's another one. What should I say from you? No, just to a woman to her grandmother.
Or you can just read the end part.
I haven't talked with you in so many years. I don't even know how many. But I was thinking of you and wanted to say thank you for all the things you taught me when I was a little girl. For example, you taught me to make doll clothes, and I still think about how much I love doing that. And now that I'm grown, I still love making things, and I think in that way we're genetically linked. I think you loved making things as much when you were alive as I love making things now. I wish you were here so I could share with you some of the things I love. I feel that my hands share something with your hands, and my memory of you is linked in my fingers. I love you and miss you. And this was from Tony, as it turns out, to my grandmother.
Oh,
that is very sweet. Beautiful. And then I have another one, which I thought was particularly wonderful, and it was a surprise to me. "Dear Richard, occasionally I have dreams about you, and it surprises me how alive you feel in them. I can feel you as if we are kids, a tender closeness. After you died, I planted a magnolia tree for you, and although I haven't checked it for several years, I believe that it's growing well. I don't miss you, but I enjoy the memories of you. We really were brothers. Love, Mark."
Wow.
And then here's another one, wonderful one, from a father to his son. "I remember when I used to come home from work and you would be waiting to go tide pooling. The first words out of your mouth, 'Dad, let's go tide pooling.' We'd barefoot down to the beach. I wouldn't even change my work clothes, and if we were in luck, the tide would be low. We got to know the special geography that was hidden most of the time from view. We had our special nooks and crannies and sea urchins that we almost knew by name. And I knew those days were flying by like a rocket into the dark night sky. Love, Dad."
Wow.
So there's quite a range here, you know.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guests today are Tony Dior and Betsy Dockhorn, and that was Betsy reading some letters from her project, which is titled again... What was
Dictation, Tell Me a Letter.
Dictation, Tell Me a Letter. What amazes me is how perfect those all sound.
Yes. And they just, people
it's
just
so poetic.
Sat down. Yeah, and told me. They just sat down and the words came out. It was a beautiful thing. I was so moved by myself, by the experience of sitting with people. And what I'd like to do also, as the weather gets warmer, is I want to get a card table and sit out on the square.
At Art Walk.
Some other evenings maybe, but for sure Art Walk.
Do you think that if you sat there with a typewriter and printed the thing out to give to people that it would be the same?
I don't know. Sometimes at Flying Leap, because of the way our space was set up, if people, the room where I was had two doorways, and I found that if both doorways were open, it was kind of like a pass-through hallway, and there wasn't that sort of intimacy or quiet or privacy that some people wanted. On the other hand, some people were totally fine with people coming in and out, and so I just kind of left it up to each person. But I tried to create, I think the expression is kind of a sacred space where people could be mostly just comfortable and everybody
express themselves.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly did.
Well, that so would change it. You're absolutely right. Yeah. If I were to go into a more public space. But that could be very interesting, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Tony, let's talk a little bit more about the paper that you're using and how you decide what paper to use on a project and what are some of the things that the paper's made out of?
In my case, let's see. I'm very attracted to the properties of paper, but sometimes I'll use things like one of my books. I call it the toothpick book. It's made from glassine envelopes, and I think I've carried around these glassine envelopes for many years. I love the transparency of the paper and the kind of brittle crackliness of the glassine paper. And it in itself, they weren't such precious things, but because they're a little bit old-fashioned, kind of like the typewriter, there's some nostalgia associated with them. So I'm intrigued by papers that have some texture, some translucency, and especially interested in Asian papers, handmade papers, because they're thin and strong and delicate, and so that's important for me in the materials that I choose, that sense of delicacy, especially because my books are small.
So glassine envelopes, would that be like what you used to get postage stamps in if you ordered
them
for collectors? Oh, those are so cool, aren't they?
Yes, and they are so cool, and that's what I thought too. So
So
I needed to utilize them somehow. I made one book out of some old tea bags, which are also so cool because they were actually used tea bags, and the tea had dyed around the edges of the paper that's used to make the tea bags. And I think I just happened one day to leave one sitting out on my counter, and it dried, and it looked beautiful, and I was attracted to it because it was so beautiful, and so that became a page of a book.
Wow. You know, as you're talking, I have this memory of making a tiny book for my dollhouse when I was a little girl. A really tiny book.
Mm. Maybe still around somewhere.
It
Mom,
could
what
be.
Do you say?
People are drawn to the or at least the bookmakers that I know are drawn to the book form itself because it carries so much meaning to all of us in our culture. I mean, the book is just so fundamental to exchange of information. And remember when I was little, I made books, I think, and people love it.
Yeah. And the in terms of the binding, you pay a lot of attention, you said, to the binding.
Right.
And what are some of the different materials that you've used for binding?
Well, let's see. I have used different materials, but primarily it's different structures that interest me about the binding. And almost all of the binding that I've done is historical in some way, but they're new to me. Like, I often will use what's called an accordion structure. It's a Japanese binding. There's another binding that I learned through the Center for the Book at University of Iowa, and that's a stiff leaf binding, and it's especially designed for pages that are stiff, so it's called stiff leaf binding. And all of the books that have stitching, I use a traditional linen thread, and it's used because it's so strong, but it's also something very beautiful about it.
So you stitch it all by hand?
Everything is done by hand.
Wow.
And
cutting the bookboard that the covers are glued onto, tearing down a big piece of paper. What do they come? Usually 30 by 48 or something.
Well, maybe not that big,
but they can
something.
Be that big.
Yeah, they can be.
And folding the paper in a particular way so that you then create pages for the book, which are then collected and sewn together.
Okay.
It's very... What do we figure? It takes like 20, 30 hours to make a book.
It's time-consuming.
It's very time-consuming.
Wow.
But it's something like, because it's sewing, it's reminiscent of other sorts of sewing structures.
Right.
Quilt making, and there's all the just the little stitches that add up to, in this case, a bound book. And in many of the historical structures, the thread is part of the decorative element, and I don't think any of the books I have on view are showing that. But
they would have like an exposed spine as opposed to a wrapped spine, like is more typical in a book, so the stitches would actually show.
So you actually have a book called The Book as Art.
Yes, we each have a copy of this book.
We brought this to...
We got this because we want to refer... We were trying to think of one or two of our very favorite... personal favorites of book artists, and it was pretty hard. We both are really fond, is that the right word, of one of our teachers in Iowa City, Julia Leonard, does phenomenal work, and she's been a real driving force at the Center for the Book, Julie Leonard.
I guess I just wanted to say that if people are interested to investigate book art, then a good place to go would be the University of Iowa Center for the Book.
And do they have a website that people
they
can
do have they a website, do. But I think if you just Google University of Iowa Center for the Book,
right.
you can find it.
Or if you put in Center for the Book, there are many all around the country, you know, that are really significant, that do incredible work,
wow.
who are not, they are not all affiliated with universities, but, you know, Minneapolis, New York,
I'm really
where
glad
else.
To know that.
Portland.
Books are not going out of style.
Well, that's a whole other conversation.
Yes.
The
well, let's
the book.
Actually wrap up with that.
Yeah.
I'd like both of your comments on what you see as the future of the book.
Hard to say. I mean, I'm a materialist and a person that loves the artifact of the book, and I think that, you know, digital technology is kind of unbeatable and incomparable in the way that it's affected our lives, you know, for the good, you know, global technology and all of that. But I really love a handmade book and holding a book, the structure of the book. I would be sad if we went to all digital. And there's a huge conversation now in
Absolutely.
Academia about the future of the book and digital life.
I think because it's digital media is so efficient and really becoming more and more popular that the physical book is becoming a little bit more precious, and because of that, people are drawn to it, and I think more and more artists are drawn to it. So that's where we'll see I think the book will remain, but it might be less.
More and more as an art form.
More and more as an art form.
As opposed to just a delivery of information vehicle.
I think so. I think so.
Possibly.
Well, eventually, if we run out of ability to make electricity, there will be no more digital. Well,
that's true, too.
That's true. And then we'll have our books.
Yes.
Our
books, we
Lucky
will.
Lucky us.
Well, this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we've been talking with Betsy Dockhorn and Tony Dior about The Book as Art. And if you stay tuned now, we're going to bring on our next guest, who is an expert on books and a book collector, John Stimson. And thank you so much, Betsy and Tony, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Sorry, thank you very much, Monica and Caroline.
Okay, so let me...
Oh,
I'm
good.
So we have a special announcement to make.
I just wanted to very much acknowledge John Stimson because he heard my plea for onion skin over the airwaves. And as he walked into the studio for his part of this talk, he brought me a lovely sheaf of onion skin. So thanks, John.
Listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline on KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And we're back talking about the book as art. And our next guest is John Stimson, who is also a longtime Fairfield resident and artist, just like our last two guests. Welcome to Writer's Voices, John.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
And he has brought some beautiful illustrations of books.
So I guess we could identify you as a book collector.
Among other things, yeah, that's one of my, that is probably my only real vice except for coffee.
John told me this morning that he has 4,000 books.
Something like that.
They're
uncountable at this point. Yes. And I think they're multiplying.
And their own. Mm-hmm.
What age did you begin collecting books?
Age zero. I can remember having books treasured. I still have the one Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was a very inspiring book from the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. I'm dating myself here. And not only the illustrations and the story, but just the physicality of the book, just the smell of it. And it was a very brand new style back then. We were getting away from the classical look of the books towards the 1960s fresh new style of book covers and illustrations. So it was astounding.
Wow. Well, Mom, we come from a long line of people who like to keep books.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes, your father collected Civil War books.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather collected books about the Civil War.
Civil War collector of books, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, then they passed on to my dad. And so I have some, you know, I don't know, I have so much stuff from.
So, John, do you collect a certain type of book, or are you an eclectic collector?
Very eclectic. As a matter of fact, I brought with me today some books that I just picked up at the library book sale, Fairfield Public Library book sale, which is ongoing. Not that one. I just brought that for other reasons. Yeah, that's a nice old book. But I have found some really nice old books there, too. Of course, they have their semi-annual book sale, too, which is like a shark feeding frenzy. people seriously get practically into fisticuffs over these.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, my.
It's very competitive. But anyway, the ongoing book sale I just picked up today. Just to illustrate the eclectic nature of my collecting, the first one I spotted is a little museum guidebook from Sweden And this is a guidebook to the royal palace called Drottningholm, which means Queen's Island. And it was originally designed in the 1600s, and then the current building is as it was during the 1700s.
Oh, wow.
And the thing that sold me on this book, you know, I flipped through it. It looks interesting enough. But there is a photo of the Queen's Library. And that did it for me. That pulled the trigger for me. It's an absolutely beautiful Rococo room, stacks and stacks of really lovely looking leather-bound volumes with engraved plates and whatnot. So that kind of image really epitomized to me it's the essence of the culture, the book culture, which it doesn't worship books, but we worship through books. And so books deserve the dignity that you would give something in a shrine. It's not that we are worshiping the altar pieces, but we worship through the altar pieces. So books are definitely the servants of worship, but they are definitely of the status of something which touches on the divine. And of course, to the opposite extreme, I also collect books that in their let's say humble nature illustrate something beautiful in that they are so crass, they are so wonderfully trashy. Now, these are book covers of pulp novels that were published by the Penguin and pocketbooks and whatnot. But before the year 1965, there was something extraordinarily beautiful about the tackiness. Now, right around 1965, it was a watershed year. There became a new style of tackiness that is no longer beautiful. Maybe I'm prejudiced, but in many things.
What changed about it?
A kind of self-consciousness that was absent before then. A kind of corporate mentality that was absent before then. Almost like changing from childhood into young adulthood. Childhood is so innocent, and so it's so earnest. And then there's a period where we become jaded, and things become, we want to fit in rather than standing out. Mm. And so 1965 was just about the time when corporate America began to think in terms of maximizing profit rather than creating something new and exciting. So
after that, maybe things were more derivative,
much
less
more derivative,
originality.
Yes, right, and much more formula-based. In other words, they had figured out certain psychologies. But before then, it was a real game.
So the books that you have, one of them is
Kill Him Twice, a Shel Scott thriller by Richard S. Prather. And the illustration shows theatrical spotlights on a very scantily dressed young lady, and then two corpses in the background, two men in gray suits. Yes, over 30 million Shel Scott books sold, and it's the paper is browning, and it was printed on with the cheapest possible typesetting, and yet there's something about it that is inexplicably beautiful. Look at the back cover with the pistol and the hand there. And the other one is A Tangled Web, Nicholas Blake, and it shows a not clad at all young lady in the center of a spider web. Mm. And
Now I have to ask, do you read all the books that you collect?
Well, okay, not all of them are what you would call reading books. I have many novels and also some nonfiction books that are to be read, but many of my books are reference books or how-to books or in some way they are not linear reading books. You don't have
to, not
as though they have a
sit
plot.
Down and read them.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
So they're either reference books or art books. So I have here a wonderful book that I picked up It's a large paperback, but of a large format. It's called Lift Up Thine Eyes, a book of inspirational Bible masterpieces. And so it's just a collection of historical works of art relating to biblical themes. There's Albrecht Dürer's Praying Hands. You know, there's Hans Memling. There's Raphael and Giotto and many different artists represented, but they are printed in a large format with a very nice color reproduction of monumental paintings on biblical themes. Mm. So I couldn't resist that.
Well, I understand.
Paperback books at the library are 50 cents. I mean,
oh, please. Yeah. On the front, I think, is the Annunciation.
Yes, right.
Mm. Beautiful.
That's a lovely medieval painting.
I've seen that representation before.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And another book that really hits home, this is exactly the kind of book that I will put in my core collection. It's called Author Unknown, On the Trail of the Anonymous, by Don Foster. Now, Don Foster is, you wouldn't recognize the name probably, but he is historically very important because he practically invented the science of library forensics. Okay, now, library forensics involves the use, the study of language as evidence in court cases. Now, Don Foster used his skills, his knowledge and experience, to be able to unravel mysteries about anonymously written books or notes or other bits of writing that, and he could trace them back to their anonymous author by the use of language. He says that language is as distinctive as DNA.
So this is similar, like biblical scholars who say certain books couldn't have been written by who they're attributed to because of other writings we have that we know are from them or something like
that. That's related, but then even more specifically to dialect and the personal take on language, their own use of English language, and this is even more specific. It's even more individual than dialect.
And their voice, as you.
Yes, their voice, their individual voice, exactly.
So not only is your handwriting a signature, but what you wrote is just
how
signature as well.
Yes. And most people have at least two voices in their writing. One is as though you were writing a business letter, and then another one is on a more personal level, how you would write in a diary, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes we have a third voice, which is one of, if you have a specific person that you're writing to, depending on how you perceive that person, whether you are writing with praise or contempt, then you acquire another voice.
Mm.
And the Japanese language is structured in such a way that there are three completely different languages according to you speaking, whether you're speaking to an equal, an inferior, or a superior.
Yeah.
The entire phrasing and structure of the language is different. So it's the same with our unconscious voice in writing. Depending on who is our audience, who is our readership, our voices change. So this fellow, Don Foster, is an expert in that field, and he is able to crack very, very obstinate mysteries by his use of library science.
I write memoir, and that's telling a story, and that's kind of even a different voice in a way, isn't it?
Yes, that's your own personal memoirs, but to be read by other people. Now, interestingly enough, Mark Twain's autobiography, which just came out last December, he had insisted that the publisher, that his family wait 100 years after his death before publishing, because it was just too much of a loaded cannon, too much personal at stake, because he was writing as though to himself. Very, very personal, very intimate writing.
And he wanted to be able to be honest without having to think about the repercussions
exactly.
who would be hurt by what he was saying.
And liability and all that.
Yes.
Now, the last book that I bought, and this is pretty frivolous here, but it is of a subject that is of interest to me. If somehow we were to encounter a truly alien life form from a different planet, a different solar system, a different galaxy, how would that likely appear? So this book, it's called Barlow's Guide to Extraterrestrials, and it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek because it's published in the form of a guidebook to zoology or plant life. And so it purports to be an authority on the various alien life forms that you might encounter when roaming the galaxy. And I'm not usually a fan of fantasy art, science fiction art, but this is pretty good. And so,
pretty wild.
Yes, worth a dollar to me.
And all of these different extraterrestrials are from science fiction literature.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. So it is not only a guidebook frivolously to alien life forms, but it is literally a reference book to science fiction stories about alien life forms. So there is actually some real merit to it in terms of...
It's quite fun.
Yes, it is. And it has real value in terms of it being a bibliographic source for science fiction.
One of my grandsons is a fan of C.S. Lewis. And
yes.
He said that in some of his writings, C.S. Lewis thought of there could very well be life on other planets, and God had created. They did not need to be redeemed because they did not fall.
Oh, interesting.
So they did not need, Jesus only had to come to the
right.
Our planet, and I thought that was rather interesting.
There are interesting stories on that theme, science fiction stories, about some beings who did not fall, indeed, and other races who fell just as it is supposed that humans did.
Those illustrations are really something.
Right.
Well, before we run out of time, because we only have about 5 minutes left, there's two things we need to talk about. One is your ongoing lecture series at Flying Leap.
Yes, it's called Book Wednesday, and you can guess what day it is. every Wednesday evening, more or less, at 8 o'clock at Flying Leap Art Space, which is on the west side of the Fairfield Square, I host a very informal show-and-tell book discussion. And I just choose a subject. This past week was about animal psychology and animal behavior and animal interaction with humans. This coming week, I forget the title of it, but essentially it's books about the individual spiritual search. Mass religion kind of but any individual's seeking spiritual growth and then writing, either using writing to accomplish that or writing about the experience. So that's next coming Wednesday.
A gentleman who communicates with animals telepathy, and it was very interesting.
And the other thing I want to mention quickly is that I am now in process of publishing the first actual book that I've printed. I have a letterpress printing shop, and I have an example here of a type form from that book. This is a poem that is hand typeset in lead foundry type, piece by piece.
Wow.
Okay. And then it's set up in a 1901 printing press, and then hand printed.
So each letter is a little piece of metal, and you have to put them all in the right order.
Exactly. Not only the right order, but also the correct amount of space between, and then spaces between the lines, and all the lines have to be exactly the same length so that it will lock into the press.
Wow.
That takes a long time.
And now, do you have more than one font?
Oh, yes, I have hundreds of fonts.
You have hundreds of fonts?
Including nice big old circus poster wood type. huge old type.
Where did you get this?
Over many years, I've been collecting that also. Yes, starting in about 1981.
And how large is the press? How much?
It weighs 1,000 pounds. It stands about 5.5 feet tall. It takes up most of my living room.
Now, is this the way that all books were printed up until a certain time?
Up until a certain time,
which
yes.
would have been when?
Starting around 1798, there were books that were published starting with the lithograph process. But letterpress, especially hand typeset printing, was done continuously. Has been done continuously since 1445 or so.
So, wow.
And this is handmade paper.
But it must be so time-consuming to do.
Yes, it is. On the other hand, there are many advantages to it, one of which is its beauty and permanence. Yeah, these are papers that I've made, either from virgin linen and cotton, or recycled junk mail, or recycled old books.
Yeah. Ooh. Mm-hmm.
So... wow. And I do bookbinding and many other
things. So you are making, printing this book of poetry on handmade paper?
The paper is not handmade, although the cover illustration is made on fine Chinese tissue paper, handmade tissue paper. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming this will be a limited edition.
Limited to 200. Mm-hmm. And it will be, it's a small enough book that it is hand-bound using a ribbon. Pierced, so it's pierced binding and then tied with a ribbon.
And the author?
My mother, actually. but she's been writing poetry for some years and has just decided that it's time to publish. And so,
wonderful.
Yes. Oh, what a gift for you to be able to give to her to publish it in this way.
Yes.
Where it will be a beautiful work of art.
And I'm hoping to have it available here in town. I'm going to ask around the various venues to see if they will carry this book.
And the title?
Reconnections.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's
very
wonderful.
Good. This is most interesting.
It really is, and unfortunately, we are out of time.
Yes,
but thank you so much.
I hope to see people on every Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock
at Flying Leap Art Space, 54.5 North Main Street. Mm-hmm. Used to be my office. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I have some. Yes. Say thanks for the person who taught you to read, because reading allows one to stay at home and travel the world.
Well, thank you, John Stimson, for being with us today, and also Betsy Dockhorn and Tony Dior, as we talked about the book as art. See you next week.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.
I also want to announce that the backyard conservation event that was scheduled for tomorrow, Saturday morning at 9:30 to pick garlic mustard, will be delayed by 1 week. That'll be April 30th instead of April 23rd. Thank you.